With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN for 10% off today. Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
The height of the Great Depression. Hobos roamed the land, riding the rails in a desperate search for jobs. Spurned by society, unwanted and homeless, they became a breed apart. Nomads who scorned the law and enforced their own. Dedicated to their destruction was the railroad man, who stood between them and their only source of survival, the trains. That's the preamble from the 1973 film Emperor of the North, which stars Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine, and Keith Carradine. The plot concerns a hobo tramp named A Number One, determined to ride the number 19 train and contend with the brakeman, Shaq, a brutal railroad worker with no qualms about killing train hoppers with a hammer blow or by letting them get sucked under a moving freight train. A Number One and his unwanted sidekick, Cigarette, pull a bunch of Looney Tunes-style sabotage on the train, in part to break Shaq's will, but mostly to slow down number 19, so they can scramble aboard. The film's climax arrives in the form of a Lee Marvin versus Ernest Borgnine fight on a moving flat car. A Number One has an axe, and Shaq is armed with a thick chain length. And it ends with A Number One proving that he is the king of the Northwest hobos by launching Shaq off the train and tumbling down a hill. The last we hear of him is a booming declaration that we haven't heard the last of Shaq as his voice shrinks away.
Yahoo!
At that moment, Shaq is the world that denigrates hobos and bums, their terminology, and A Number One is every person struck down by the Great Depression. It is a pitiable victory. Cigarette, the unwanted sidekick who has been aping A Number One's every move, starts yapping about how great he and A Number One are, how they beat the Shaq together. A Number One grabs Cigarette by the lapels, says,
"Kid, you got no class,"
and throws the young man off the trestle bridge they're crossing into the water below.
Saw that coming.
He surfaces and watches A Number One, facing him on the flat car, rolling away. A Number One, now the Emperor of the North, bellows at young Cigarette.
"Run like the devil! Stay off the tracks! Forget it! It's a bum's world for a bum! You had the juice, kid, but not the heart! And they both go together! So stay off the train! She'll throw you under for sure!
And this is all while he's getting further away on a train.
It's kind of hilarious because his voice stays very, you can hear everything he's saying, and he's not going far away. 40 seconds, he's just leaving on a train, and it's so far away, and it's in the Pacific Northwest, I think in Oregon for that scene. And so he's just going down the gorge, and he's still like, you could have been a meat eater, kid. It's like, it's pretty great.
It's a story about people with nothing in a time of hunger, struggling to be seen, to survive, grasping onto even the flimsiest of legacies. A number one and Shaq are mere men. Their only true difference is that Shaq has a job and a license to kill. And I bring this all up to paint a picture of the hardcore lives of rail riders. The A number one character is based on a real person, and things like that happened. There was the peril of jumping onto a moving freight train, riding with strangers, always being in the middle of nowhere and far from help, where a wrong word or look could mean a beating or worse. You could get jackrolled, or robbed while you were sleeping, or slip from a handhold, and the train would devour you and spit your body out in pieces. The railhopper's term for this is getting butchered up. It's a dangerous lifestyle. By the mid-1990s, the United States population of train tramps and hobos dropped to only a few thousand from their Depression-era numbers of 2 million plus. This turnaround began in 1941, when the U.S. began actions during World War II, which led to the military draft and the creation of millions of jobs in defense and war industries. A possible origin of the term hobo is from transient workers carrying their tools with them as they traveled. They were called hoboys, which may have evolved into hobos.
That's a fun fact.
Thank you. A man named Choo Choo Johnson taught me that in a documentary.
My name's Choo Choo Johnson.
Thank you, Choo Choo.
Choo Choo Johnson. Well, it is a tease. Next episode, we're going to be hearing from Choo Choo Johnson and Guitar Whitey.
Wow.
Pretty fun.
That is.
The man I'm telling you about today started hopping the rails as a full-time hobo lifestyle in 1991, half a century after the Second World War. He lived as a ruler in a kingdom as expansive as the contiguous United States, yet as slim as the space between the rails of the nearly 140,000 miles of freight tracks that crisscrossed the country. A nearly unstoppable man in a world where violence was the law. He called himself Sidetrack. The U.S. freight rail network is considered the largest, safest, and most cost-efficient freight system in the world. A History of North American Railroad Police, published in 1987, is quoted, "Railroad policing in the United States and Canada dates from the 1850s. These forces include more than 4,500 railroad police. By 1999, there were only 2,500 railroad agents nationally. With so few agents, sometimes there were only two agents to cover hundreds of miles of rail. Those numbers haven't improved in the last 25 years. The legend goes that the FTRA was formed in Montana in the 80s, in either Kalispell, Libby, or Whitefish. The town varies by the storyteller, as does the year, either 1982 or 86. Its first members were Vietnam veterans who'd become disillusioned with their return to average American life, eventually abandoning it altogether. The acronym initially stood for Fuck the Reagan Administration, then became Freedom Riders of America, and finally Freight Train Riders of America.
Did they just not like Reagan because he was the man or because he was Reagan?
Oh, I think it was, well, both. The FTRA was anti-government.
Oh, okay.
And so it didn't matter. It was anybody. I think because they felt the government had screwed them.
Obviously.
Yeah, which
they did.
They did. They'd first named themselves the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang, a reference to the infamous real-life outlaw supergroup whose members included Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but the name didn't stick. In the 1990s, FTRA's second-generation members became younger, those too young to fight in Vietnam. Along with these new freight riders came a growing penchant for violence. An unofficial code stood among rail riders, one of hard-line boundaries and deadly reprisals. Detective Mike Sward of Flathead County, Montana, defined them simply as predators. Quote, they like to enforce their philosophies, opinions, and wills on other train riders. Those philosophies and opinions include white supremacist and anti-government sentiments and ideologies. Cast off as an urban myth, the riders went unnoticed in their early years as their numbers grew. But the group was there, if you looked, passing by on the very edge of society. From Portland's CBS affiliate, KOIN, or COIN, Channel 6, a featured 1998 piece titled Murder on the Rails, Part 1 and 2. These clips feature interviews with independent rail hoppers regarding their experience on the rails and their knowledge of and interactions with the FTRA. K-Line, a college-educated artist who has a home when they are not riding the rails, said, "The rules on the rails don't apply to the rules in society, and it's an escape." The reporter replies, "That sounds frightening." K-Line says, "Yes, it is. I'm very reluctant to turn FTRA members in. I don't know what that is, the hobo code or something. I mean, their rules, they don't have any."
That's a really interesting point of view. Someone who chooses to do it but has a home. I never really considered that aspect because I don't know a lot about that lifestyle.
Right.
But do you have a little more information on that?
There seemed to be a lot of newer, in the 90s, newer writers that did it as
a hobby,
self-expression. There's one. One of the people who's killed in this episode was traveling with a friend, and he would always bring a couple books with him, and he would meditate and read about Taoism, and Eastern philosophy and things like that. So, yeah, I think people use it as sort of a spiritual thing sometimes, too.
That's and also we were just
low
watching
cost travel.
About Sierra mm-hmm. Farrell, that country singer
yes.
that we're suddenly in love with.
Yes.
And that she toured the country busking, but hopping the train. And rode it around the country and just got off in Portland, went and busked. Got off in Seattle, went and busked. It's pretty cool and wild.
And dangerous. And don't do
yeah,
that. And
scared.
I do not suggest that.
Matt and I always joked about it when we were in high school.
I'm
like,
really
let's
glad
just
you...
go hop on the Mm-mm. train.
Well, ever since I saw The Adventures of Natty Gann, I wanted to do that as well and have a wolf as a pet. So.
Well, yes, of course.
Ooh. And now you have one, Mr. Henry.
That's right.
Wolf boy.
The reporter also speaks with Robert Eugene Smitty Smith, a veteran hobo. He's maybe 60 years old, but looks much older from years of hard living. The reporter asks, "You miss your family?" And Smitty, with tears in his eyes, says, "I ain't got no family." So drunk he can barely stand, Smitty loses gear from his pack and stumbles at the edge of the tracks as a train rolls by. A fellow train hopper helps him gather his things and get him onto a car. This is Dave, along with his companion doggy. Now angry with Smitty for potentially drawing attention to themselves. The reporter, Craig Cheatham, speaks with Dave, who denies being an FTRA member, but admits he does associate with them. As the reporter hops a boxcar with Dave, it's the only place Dave will talk openly, the camera catches the words "Hole in the Wall," one of the FTRA's original names, on his backward puffy baseball cap.
I love that the reporter did this mm-hmm. with them.
That's cool.
Talk about on the scene reporting. That's crazy.
Dave tells the reporter that when the train reaches its stop at the freight terminal in Pasco, Washington, he will beat up Smitty for violating the unwritten hobo code. And then the report just ends. No further mention of Smitty, and I couldn't find him during my research. I was looking for a death notice or any sort of article, and I might have found it, but it was impossible to tell.
Was this because he was speaking to a reporter? Was that the code he was breaking?
No, the code was that he was so drunk that he couldn't get on the train, and they have to do that as quickly as possible
right.
so that none of the bulls will see them. The bulls are the railroad agents.
Gotcha.
We'll see them. So,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, causing danger and getting eyes on you.
It's bad for everybody.
Yeah, got it.
From the Great Falls Tribune, because they have no home base, members frequently contact one another by leaving messages on bridge abutments or the wall of factories or warehouses. The messages usually include their nickname, the date, and a cryptic message. The FBI has begun an investigation into the world of the FTRA. According to FBI reports, from 1991 to 1995, 60 homicides occurred in or near train yards across the country. The state of Utah had a record number of murders in 1991, 54. Two of those killed in the state that year were believed to have been murdered by members of the FTRA. 45-year-old Barbara Boggs Richardson's throat-cut body was found on May 12th in a rail yard. There were several witnesses, also rail riders with names like Pyro, Red Dog, and Shotgun. Jeremy Abshire, another rider, was charged with second-degree murder and was later acquitted of the charges. Randall Lee Jones, 41, was also found in a rail yard and had been stabbed 13 times. He was Barbara Richardson's camp husband, murdered 4 months before she was. It was said Barbara had been asking questions seeking clues to ID Randall's killer. Salt Lake County Sheriff Sergeant Jerry Townsend said, "These are difficult cases because of the type of people we're dealing with. They have a unique code of ethics against testifying against one another." Salt Lake City Detective Sergeant Chuck Cockane said regarding the FTRA, "With all the assault cases we've had down there, and you wouldn't believe how many there are, we haven't had anyone say to us the FTRA have done it to them." Our focus today, FTRA member and enforcer Sidetrack, a.k.a. Robert Silvera, was born in Redwood City, California, and grew up in Sunnyvale, at the southern end of San Francisco Bay, west of San Jose. Silvera's father was an authoritarian bully and abuser who would beat Robert for his mistakes. When Robert was 11, his grades plummeted as he began skipping school and testing the waters of drug use, his older sister being the first person to provide him with narcotics. He was eventually expelled from school.
That's really sad.
Yeah, he had no one to turn to for any of these problems that he was having. Everyone in his family seemed to sort of almost encourage those things.
Cool. Weird that he ended up in the position he did.
Around this age, Robert came home one day looking like he got his ass kicked. When he explained to his father that three kids had beaten him up at the park, the man forced him to return to the park to confront his attackers. His father goaded him on to hit the boys with a baseball bat he'd brought along, but Robert refused and ran home in tears. Their father-son dynamic soured as Robert matured. His anger and humiliation festered, and he turned up the intensity of the forever war with his dad. Robert once removed all but one of the lug nuts from each of the tires on his father's pickup truck.
Ooh.
But there were no reported calamities from this attempt to kill his dad. As a teen, Robert stole a motorbike and was sent to a facility for juvenile offenders. He was molested there and swore to make those responsible pay for what they did. Having spent a year in jail for auto theft and unable to hold a steady job, at 21, Silvera hit the road, hitchhiking from California to Arizona. This was when he committed his first murder, which we'll cover in part two next week. Robert was first married in May of 1984. He and his first wife had met when she was just 14, while he was inking tattoos on her father.
Yikes.
They eventually had one daughter together. Around October 1987, on a trip to Stockton, California to visit an uncle, Silvera said he was taking a quick trip to the grocery store and he'd be right back. He didn't return for several days. He was likely hopping freight trains and getting high. He was using both heroin and crack by this time. This happened a few more times until he finally never returned. She later divorced him. Silvera admitted he took up rail hopping as a way to keep himself from hurting his wife and baby. One night he woke up bathed in sweat from a dream in which he killed them both. He woke up the next morning with the urge to kill them coursing through his body, so he quickly packed a few belongings and left for the last time.
At least he could recognize that. So that's good, I guess.
And he, I believe, preferred to take those feelings out on men because of his father. Sidetrack's killing series began with the bludgeoning death of transient Anthony Garcia on April 9, 1989. The body was found at an encampment near the base of a railroad trestle in West Sacramento, California. Garcia was hit over the head, possibly with an axe. Within the camp, mistrust of the police and fear of being tagged as a snitch made it nearly impossible to get anyone to talk. Police were seeking information about a man in his 30s whom several witnesses reluctantly admitted having seen spending time with Garcia. Silvera married for the second time in November 1990, after he and his new bride moved out to Mississippi. Around 4 months into the second marriage, Silvera's new stepson sat his mom down to tell her the new hubby was on drugs, and she decided to go into full denial mode, deciding her kid was just trying to get them to split up. Even when a state drug agent dropped by to tell her he was on probation and a very bad man, she would not believe her wonderful and caring husband was anything but a sweetie. 5 months into their union, after an argument about his drug use, Silvera left and never returned. In 1991, Silvera became a member of FTRA, the same year his second wife kicked him out of the house. He was soon living exclusively on the rails, which increased the frequency of his murders. Initiation into the FTRA goes like this, or at least it did for Sidetrack. After taking up freight hopping full-time, a prospective member had to ride around the U.S. with a veteran rail rider. Throughout this trip, their actions, attitudes, and toughness were assessed to see if they would fit into the FTRA. And Sidetrack fit quite well, even earning his moniker on the ride, after disappearing for 3 days on a beer run. On return from the around-the-country trip, all the FTRA members in the area threw a huge party in their camp, or jungle, as they call it. With a large group, you could see the gang's color-coded factions. They wore bandanas or stripped-up t-shirts around their necks, fastened with a concho, which is a little metal buckle like you'd wear with a bolo tie. Northern riders wore black rags, southern riders wore red, and central U.S. riders wore blue. Conchos tended to be silver. A gold concho signified the rider wearing it had covered a million rail miles. The riders start the party with whiskey and Thunderbird wine. The initiate is presented with their concho, which is then held over a fire while members take turns cutting their fingies and letting the blood drip onto the metal. As for the rag or a bandana, which was black in Sidetrack's case, it gets urinated on and stomped into the dirt by the gang, and the recruit then has to wear it unwashed for a week.
Oh, cool. Yuck.
Cool club.
At some point, the initiate is challenged when a beer is poured over their head. Then they have to fight. If one survives, congratulations, you are now an esteemed member of the Freight Train Riders of America. Here's your piss bandana. There were an estimated 2,000 FTRA members in the 1990s. Burlington Northern Railroad Special Agent Bruce McGill believed, of that number, there were as many as 75 hardcore members like Silvera. McGill said the group was first formed for mutual protection, but evolved into a group that preys on other transients. Quote, you belong to the FTRA and walk up to any FTRA camp, you're welcomed. If there are a couple FTRAs in a boxcar, the others get out. Or should get out. July 8, 1992, Darren Royal Miller was, quote, found dead in his sleeping bag at a pond less than a quarter mile from the Union Pacific Railroad tracks in Thompson Springs, Utah. 29-year-old Darren originally hailed from Minnesota. He and two friends were hopping trains to New Hampshire, and they decided to spend the night at the pond, a local gathering spot. Miller was killed by numerous blunt force injuries to his head. A witness described speaking with Miller and his travel companions a few hours before the murder. One of those men was described as tall and lean, with tattoos covering his arms, wearing a sleeveless denim jacket with the monikers and tags of other riders scrawled on the back. He wore a black bandana and a silver concho. The word freedom was inked on the left side of his neck. Silvera moved around a lot. His affiliation with the FTRA meant others on the rails would have his back. It also meant he felt he had carte blanche to kill whomever he was near whenever he decided that they'd enraged him, or he saw something that they had that he wanted. Sidetrack did anything he pleased. 52-year-old Willie James Clark was out canning in Atlanta in mid-January 1994 when he was interviewed by a writer from the Atlanta Journal. The focus of the article is the city's treatment of its unhoused, houseless/people-in-need community. During large events like the impending Super Bowl 28, which took place 11 days later at the Georgia Dome, that population was arrested or otherwise swept from the area. Willie said if he got anywhere near the Dome's downtown location during that time, quote, they're going to take my hiney to jail.
Not your hiney.
Willie wasn't joking around. He got way away from downtown Atlanta by making his way to Tallahassee, Florida. On April 28th, less than 3 months after that article was published, Willie's body was found in a cluster of trees at a small park, the land of which sloped upward to a set of railroad tracks. Willie had been killed with strikes to the head and robbed. Investigators found one of the belt loops on Willie's pants was cut, and later learned he wore a chain wallet, which was secured at his waist. A police spokesman said Clark would receive a pauper's burial if none of his family could be found within 30 days. Michael Garfinkel encountered Silvera at a transient camp near a train switching yard in Emeryville, California, a few miles north of Oakland. He walked into their camp, and when Garfinkel and his three companions told him to get out, he said, I go where I like. The young men pulled out axe handles and told him to fuck off. Silvera pulled out a 9mm handgun, and the group scattered. One of them tripped and fell, Michael Garfinkel. Silvera, holding his own axe handle, loomed over the man and allegedly said, welcome to the last day of your life, before beating Michael to death with at least 13 blows. Silvera hung on to the axe handle, sanding it down to remove the blood embedded in the wood. He carried sandpaper specifically to remove bloody fingerprints from his murder weapons. He also used battery acid to burn off the blood-soiled fingerprints. Michael Garfinkel's parents established a $10,000 reward for information that brought his killer to justice, though this had no measurable impact on the case. James Lee Bowman, a.k.a. Hooter, was very tall and thin. He was 38 and dressed punk, with facial and tongue piercings and concrete-spiked hair. He was a rail hopper like his girlfriend Blondie. They met and began traveling together 3 months prior. It was April 21, 1995. Hooter and Blondie were in Salt Lake City, where Hooter was off collecting his food stamps. He then went to one of the city's membership-only drinking clubs, where he bought cigarettes and a few bottles of vodka, possibly by selling his food stamps for 50 cents on the dollar, which is called double clutching. Silvera was also in Salt Lake City that day. He was there to set up food stamp benefits under a false ID he'd purchased at a flea market in the name of Brad Foster. At the welfare office, Silvera grabbed his gear and ran when the computer showed that Brad Foster was receiving benefits in multiple states.
Ooh.
He ran all the way to the railroad tracks, where he met Hooter and Blondie. While Blondie took off on an errand, Hooter and Silvera started pounding the vodka, mixing it with OJ and even chocolate milk. When Blondie returned, she and Hooter began arguing, and she stormed off. The two men kept drinking, finishing 2/5 of vodka within 90 minutes. That's so much
a
alcohol.
Lot, right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes, very much so.
Emboldened by the booze, Hooter started asking if Silvera was FTRA, which enraged him. Silvera punched Hooter in the eye, knocking him down, then pulled him to his feet and stabbed him in the rib cage with a folding buck knife. Throwing Hooter to the ground, Silvera grabbed a 2x4 and brought it down on Hooter's skull like he was splitting a block of wood.
Oof.
He caved in Hooter's head until the makeshift weapon snapped in half. Silvera then left the campsite, entirely splattered with blood, and hopped a train. It was after dark when police first responded to the scene. Blondie was the one who called it in. She'd returned to camp after a couple of hours, hoping Hooter had cooled off from their argument, and at first thought her partner, leaning against a culvert, had passed out from drinking. As she neared him, shouting his name, Blondie saw the blood, then the pain and lacerated damage pounded into Hooter's face. She rushed to a nearby 7-Eleven and called the police department. Blondie later described Brad Foster as having sandy brown hair, a beard and mustache, and the word freedom tattooed on the left side of his neck. At first, investigators somehow thought Hooter's death was accidental, that he'd fallen and cracked his head open. It was nighttime. They said, oh, it was nighttime when we did it. At autopsy, though, it became immediately apparent that it was a homicide.
And this was the guy that shared the two bottles?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, that's the plus, is he maybe didn't feel it.
I think most of them probably didn't feel anything after the first hit.
Yeah, once you're out.
Mm-hmm.
Oof, brutal.
Lead detective Guy Yoshikawa sent a teletype to all Western law enforcement departments describing the crime against Hooter and asking if anyone had a similar case. He then checked the welfare office and received confirmation that Brad Foster had been in the day Hooter was killed. And Brad Foster was Silvera with a fake ID. Yoshikawa had the name Brad Foster and the freedom neck tattoo description entered into the county jail system, and there was a result, Robert Silvera. But he was always on the move, using false names with no record of his travels. And these being early internet days, tracking him down seemed nearly impossible. Food stamps sealed another man's fate in El Paso, Texas, when Charles Randall Boyd made pals with Robert Silvera outside of the welfare office on July 17, 1995. It was later discovered Silvera had benefits for food stamps in nearly 30 different names around the country.
Whoa.
It was a lucrative business for him. And that was why he was constantly, part of the reason he was constantly on the move, to get
he's
that cash.
Got to go get his other stamps.
Stamps and then probably sell them for money or drugs. Boyd, a transient worker like Silvera sometimes was, said there was a place he could get some work at the Double D Ranch, 120 miles from El Paso in Van Horn, Texas. They traveled there and worked for a few days before packing up Boyd's van and driving to Pierceville, Kansas, so Boyd could visit his daughter, who was not happy to see her dad and Silvera, soon asking them to leave. It was July 26th, 9 days after Silvera and Boyd met. They drove a few hours away to the Cottonwood Campground at Canopolis State Park. Boyd set up his 5-person dome tent Silvera cut down wood, built a fire, and cooked stovetop stuffing to share.
I love stuffing.
Oh, mm-hmm. Me too.
Yummy, yummy.
That's why I put that detail in there. They went to sleep after dinner and a minor disagreement. Silvera woke in the early morning, crept out of the tent, and picked up a concrete block lying nearby. He moved back toward the tent, raised the block, and brought it down where Boyd's head would be, ripping through the flimsy wall. He picked up the block and brought it down again and again on Boyd when the injured man moaned. Silvera had earlier taken Boyd's wallet without his knowledge. Within the 9 days Boyd knew Silvera, there was another murder for which the boxcar killer was responsible. Robert Silvera was in Albany, California on July 22nd when he crossed paths with a familiar face, James McLean, a.k.a. Jesus Christ McLean, 50 years old. J.C., once a train hopper, was a Vietnam veteran who had settled in the Albany camp. Greeting Silvera, McLean invited him to his hooch, or shack, or hut, to have a couple of beers. As it had been before, an argument ensued, this time over $5 in trade. McLean told Silvera to get out of his hooch, turning his back and walking to the far end of the space. By the time McLean turned around, Silvera was already on him, bringing the axe handle down square on JC's forehead, crumpling him to the ground. Silvera then leaned down to the dazed, defenseless man and stabbed him low in the right ribcage, twisting the blade and watching McLean breathe his last. When McLean was dead, Silvera covered his face by laying a folding chair across it, something he often did in shame after he killed. Silvera couldn't handle their open eyes, which had seen who Sidetrack really was. He took JC's wallet and boots, left the camp, and hopped a train under moonlight. The murders of JC McLean and Charles Boyd were so close together that it strained believability Silvera could have committed both. Investigators would later learn that a couple of hotshot or priority trains could have had him back in Texas within 24 hours. Sidetrack had plenty of time to kill Boyd. This is something he later confirmed by drawing the route map he would have used for the detectives interviewing him. This is the end of part one. In part two, murders in Montana, Oregon, and California, the admittedly anticlimactic capture of Robert Sidetrack Silvera, and the Elvis cop to whom the killer spilled his guts. That may sound strange to you, but only because it is. Here's a little tease.
Daddy, please.
Please tell me why.
Please tell me why.
That people got to drink and drive. Don't they know?
Don't they know?
Someone might die.
Someone might die.
When they drink and try to drive.
So that's it. I would say check out the blog. I have a ton of images and links to historical writings on the Great Depression, hobos. I have a great link to maps of where all the victims were and train maps. I have all sorts of hobo codes.
Ooh.
And writings from the real A Number One, who was a world famous hobo in his time.
Like,
and friends, he was friends with Jack London, for God's sake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Leon That's Ray crazy. Livingston is his name.
I'm going to have a busy Monday night.
Yeah, I have tons of, I know, it's like the most sources, the most images,
super
and
fun.
I'm
cool.
So sorry. All right, that's it.
All right.
Questions?
Awesome.
Comments? Bye-bye.
I look forward to it.
I love you all. Choo-choo Johnson. Bye. A Number One and his... I need to calm the heck down.
You're excited to tell us and we're excited to hear it, but it's Easter. So
I'm scared of this guy and his hammer blow.
His hammer blow?
Hey.
That sounds scary.
This is Ernest Borgnine. Ernest Borgnine on the Today Show or something, and he like whispers like he's not on mic that his key to youth is that he masturbates a lot.
But he's
very old.
Old
when he says it.
I can relate.
Very upsetting.
I masturbate a lot. Oh, and it has the funniest opening song where it's like John Denver style, like, mm-hmm. A train is not a man, and a man is not a train, but a man can go where a train can't go.
It's true.
It's so funny.
It's true.
And it's completely opposite tone of the things that happen. Like, the fight, it's not funny with
they
the things that
happen. They just liked it was a song about a train.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, it was the times. They didn't know.
They didn't know how to make movies.
Yeah, the 70s was a wild, awkward time.
A man can do things that a train never can. Going up.
Caboose something.
Ooh.
Caboose juice.
Oh.
Em knows what I'm talking about.
I said, just heard Josh say sack snack and thought you would think it's funny. To be clear, he meant semen.
Its first members were Vietnam. I need to calm down.
Yeah, take a deep breath.
Very excited about this story.
Deep belly breath. Oh, yeah. Ooh, I got a coupon.
For?
Ulta. I'm excited.
Holy shit. Detective Mike Sword of Flathead County, Montana.
Montana?
That sentence got away from me. This is a pretty short episode, too. It's only nine pages. So.
Oh, I love it when you talk dirty to me. Really making a meal out of those nine pages.
Shut up!
And I get to go to Ulta for 20% off? Oh, my gosh.
Happy Easter. They're probably not open today.
He is risen and lowered prices. They like to enforce their...
they open at noon.
I'm on Dayquil. I don't know if you knew that.
She's getting
high. Oh, yeah.
We're a CBS family through and through. This young teen is a slutty whore that does drugs. Isn't she awful?
Salt Lake City Detective Sergeant Chuck Cockane.
Oh.
Having spent some... stupid bastard. He then checked with the welfare...
with the welfare office. He checked with the welfare office to receive confirmation about Foster being the
boy
who was killed.
Voice?
That's my new voice I do for the show. Hey, buddy.
Lionel.
Hey, Lionel.
I think you messed up at
welfare office.
Oh, perfect. Okay. He then checked the welfare office. I rewrote and I just left like words I don't need anymore for about a few days.
Stupid.
I should have gone to college. Ah.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.